At this point, I want to, has Floyd come back in? I guess maybe not. Okay, if you would, turn with me to Romans chapter 8. And this is the environment regarding God as the creator and we as his stewards. And when we got down to verse 22, and let's just read that, and I'll say just a word about it of introduction. For we know that the whole of creation groans and suffers the pains of childbirth together until now, and that it is waiting for the revelation of the sons of God. That would be us, sons and daughters of God. Creation being subjected to a certain degree of futility was a subject that we had begun to address in our study of the book of Romans. And I had two or three people tell me the same thing, that our own Dr. Richard Hammer has a study that he has done that will, I think, shed a little bit more light on this Romans chapter 8, verse 22. Just as a point of introduction, Dr. Hammer is a very accomplished amateur astronomer, almost said astrologer, astronomer, and to such a degree that a number of his discoveries and pictures that he's been able to take from deep space have actually been used by those who call themselves the experts and in professional trade magazines in that area of specialization. So Chris and Rich are with us this morning, and I want you to join with me in welcoming again to this podium Dr. Richard Hammer.
Good morning. Before I get into the topic of the day, I have some bonus material, if I may. This is kind of exciting. I teach an astronomy course at Evangel. Any of my students here today? And we had our first star party out at my house Wednesday night of this week because it was a clear night. So I had 25 students plus 10 visitors, so there were 35 of us on my driveway looking through my large telescope. And something happened that night that had never happened before in 30 years of being committed to this avocation of astronomy. It was kind of a dramatic event, and I just wanted to share a little bit of that with you here this morning before I get into the topic of conversation. And the topic relates to what you see on the screen there, NEOs, which stands for near-Earth objects. And this is referring to objects that intersect the Earth's orbit. You know, we have a long orbit. It's about 200 million miles in diameter. And as we traverse our way in a slightly elliptical orbit around the sun every 365 days, and there are thousands of objects that intersect our orbit, mostly comets and asteroids. And the concern, of course, is if we're at a certain point along the orbit at the same time one of these things is, that's a potential problem. It's a very dynamic place out there. It's busy, and I just want to show you some of the problem here. This is what's called the asteroid belt, which is largely between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter, but many of those asteroids come within our orbit around the sun as well. In fact, there's literally hundreds of thousands of these things that have been cataloged. There's countless ones that haven't been. Some of these things can be the size of a pea, all the way up to a house, or some are actually hundreds of miles in diameter. Ceres is the largest. I think it's like 600 miles in diameter. This shows you another chart depicting all known NEOs, and you can see the Earth's orbit. Here's the Earth right here, and in our orbit around the sun, basically circular, all of the red dots are large asteroids that share our orbit. It's an active place, our solar system. Just take a look at this image of the far side of the moon. Look at the impacts. Every one of those craters is caused by an impact. Or you look at Callisto, the fourth moon from Jupiter. Look at it's an entirely cratered object. Or this image of Mercury taken by the Messenger spacecraft just a few days ago. And here's a close-up of it. And you can see the cratered nature of the surface. What are those craters coming from? Impacts with asteroids, with planetoids, planetesimals, and comets in a few cases. You can't read this, but I want to refer to it. This is a listing that NASA produces regularly of near-Earth objects that are going to come within a relatively short distance of the Earth on any given day. And what you'll notice here is some days there's three or four of them that go by. Tonight we have one that whizzes past the Earth. You can't read this, but it's for March 27 right here. And this object is 240 meters by 530 meters. So that's a pretty substantial object, you know, probably a quarter of a mile across that rock. But it's going to miss us by, let's see here, the 27th is going to miss us by 59 lunar distances, 59 times the distance of the moon, which sounds like a lot, but in astronomical terms, it's just a near miss. All of these would be near misses. The closest known asteroid is Apophis, which is scheduled to pass by its nearest approach on April the 13th of the year 2029. It's going to be 22,000 miles from the Earth. That's one-tenth of the distance between the Earth and the Moon. That is nothing. And when this was first discovered several years ago, the ellipse of uncertainty was large enough that it subsumed our Earth. We didn't know if we were going to get struck or not. But more recent investigations have proven that we are outside of that ellipse of uncertainty. So there's no possibility at this point that that's actually going to strike. It'll probably be a daytime object, though. You'll be able to see it tracking across the sky. That one is large. It's would have about 100 times the power of the Beringer meteor crater in Arizona. Some of you have seen that, which is almost a mile in diameter. We've cataloged 5,341 NEOs, 65 are comets, 5,276 are asteroids, 928 are potentially hazardous asteroids, or PHAs, of a kilometer or larger in size. The highest risk asteroid is called 1950 DA, possible collision event with the Earth in 2880. It would be an extinction event because of the size of that object, unless we do something about it. There have been a number of near misses. Did you read about the one last week, the size of a house, that passed by very close to the Earth and was discovered one day before it appeared? A few years ago, right around Christmas, there was a large asteroid that we discovered 4 days after it passed by. So these things are inherently difficult to find. And some of them have very eccentric orbits, so you don't know where they're going to be coming from. The key is finding them soon enough so we can do something about them. And the question is, well, what are you going to do to prevent something like this from happening? Well, one thing we could do is put a rocket near one of these objects and detonate an explosive device within a certain distance away that wouldn't pulverize it, because then you're turning a bullet into a shotgun blast. But that's going to be powerful enough, the shock wave, to lodge this thing just inches off its orbit. If we do it soon enough, early enough, with enough lead time, that's going to result in a miss. And so on July the 4th, 2005, NASA launched the Deep Impact mission to literally strike Comet 9P Temple. They launched that on the anniversary, the 50th anniversary to the day, of Bill Haley and the Comets. Hit song, Rock Around the Clock. It was the first rock and roll single to make it to the top of the best-selling records in America. And Bill Haley and the Comets, now in their 80s, were asked by NASA to come to the JPL, Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, and put a concert on for the staff 2 days after this successful mission. They weren't quite as sharp as they were in the 50s, but it was quite an amazing thing. In fact, NASA proceeded to name a new asteroid, Bill Haley. Okay. And here's an artist's depiction of what they did. And so this probe launched a probe, and it took this close-up image of this comet. And this next picture, you'll see the image of the probe actually striking this asteroid. So we know we have the ability, the technology, to move a spacecraft, a probe, to strike an object, or certainly to get close to it, and if we have enough lead time. Just like a boat at sea coming into harbor. You know, if you're almost there, a slight deviation is not going to make much difference. But if you're off a degree and you start that deviation 100 miles from shore, you're going to be off by miles by the time you reach shore. You've got to find these things early enough. There's a observatory on Haleakala Volcano on Maui, Hawaii, that is the largest base on Earth searching for these things. They have about the same staff as a local McDonald's restaurant looking for a potentially civilization-destroying object. A new asteroid. So here's what happened in my driveway last week. I was taking 20-second, 10-second images of objects, showing the students, here's a galaxy, here's a galaxy cluster, here's a star cluster, here's a nebulae, here's a double star, etc. That way they can see it on a big flat panel monitor I have rather than lining up with the eyepiece 35 people and taking a look. It just makes it so much easier. So I'm taking these 20-second, 10-second images, and this image right here I took, you can't see it that well, but as a highly trained astronomer, I immediately saw something about this that the students didn't, and that was this object right here. See that little line there? What does that denote? I had my clock drive on, of course, so the stellar background, the star field, was fixed, but anything that has proper relative motion relative to the stars in the background is going to show up as a streak, whether it's a plane, a satellite, or whatever. And as an experienced astronomer, I pretty well know what I'm looking at in a 20-second exposure based on the length of that line. And I could immediately tell from that line that it was not a jet, it was not an aircraft, and I suspected it might be an asteroid. So I immediately had a student turn his iPhone into a stopwatch and give me 30-second intervals or 50-second intervals. And I took this series. Now watch that line. So what happened is you talk about excitement. My class is watching this. We're discovering an asteroid, perhaps that had not been discovered before. We didn't know that at the time. And it may be an Earth-intersecting asteroid. It may be the asteroid to destroy civilization on Earth. And so this was high drama out in the driveway at 10:30 on Wednesday night, let me tell you. And so here's what happened. I took these images, and yesterday I did a careful analysis to begin isolating what we were seeing, eliminating any other potential suspects. So I looked at 4,200 man-made satellites that are in space right now. I looked at this very specific area of the sky where I'm taking these images last Wednesday night at 10:30, and there was no man-made satellite in this region. So then I looked at 1,000 asteroids visible with a telescope of my size. None were in this field. Then I looked at 365 comets that are visible right now through a telescope of my size. None. So it was just with kind of a sense of wonderment that I was literally confirming that we had detected an asteroid that had never before been seen or charted anywhere. I'll give the class that update. They didn't know that because I just discovered this yesterday morning. So then what do? I contacted the Minor Planet Center operated by Harvard Observatory to point this out. We need to check this out. This may be an Earth intersecting. We need time. So there's a website, you know, for submitting information. And I went to this website with all the 44 conditions have to be met to make a submission. The very first one, your email must be in ASCII format, not HTML. Well, what does that mean? So I'm struggling with doing Google searches. What's an ASCII email? And then all these requirements for the images you send has to be to the tenth of a second, universal time. You have to do this. Nah, 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 nah. I'm trying to save the Earth, and you got these bureaucratic regulations. And the bottom line is I couldn't do it. And they say, if you don't meet these explicitly, your email is rejected by a computer program. It doesn't, no human being even lay eyes on it. And you don't even get a response. And I just felt so frustrated, toiling away at my desk, trying to save humanity, and I'm not able to do it. Just share my sense of frustration. Okay. Well, I just want you to know it's not my fault. Okay. But I have tried. I should get a standing ovation at this point. But Thank you. I spent hours on this, and I will be back today, this afternoon, trying to see if I can do this. But that's the frustration. And time, valuable days are passing by that we may need. Anyway, I wanted to share that with you. It was exciting for the students, and I'll give them an update in our class tomorrow night. By the way, you're welcome to join us Monday night, 6:30 to 9 p.m. We usually have eight or so auditors in the class. Okay, now, let's get to our lesson for the day, Romans 8:28. I'm not an authority on this, but I do bring a perspective maybe that's different from a theological perspective. And isn't that's why I tell my students constantly at CBC or at Evangel to avoid what the great philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein called philosophical malnutrition, of being so, isolated in your narrow range, your narrow discipline, that you're oblivious to the currents of thought outside your own that can inform you and give you insights that you otherwise can't possibly have. And so I'm bringing an astronomical insight here, right or wrong. It's different. It's unique. And I want to share this with you. Romans 8:22. We know that the whole creation has been groaning as in the pains of childbirth right up to the present time. What does that mean? As an astronomer, you go out to the country under a dark sky in the summer at night, on a moonless night, and you look up. You want to turn that sound up a little bit? And maybe a little softer. Okay. And what do you see? You see the immensity of the universe arcing above your head, the Milky Way. You're overwhelmed by the quietness, the solitude, the serenity, the tranquility of it, the peacefulness of it. And what does it mean that the whole creation has been groaning as in the pains of childbirth? You don't hear any groaning out there. You don't hear the stars groaning. And so that verse always was a source of ambiguity to me personally. You know, as an astronomer, I should be able to make some sense out of this. Well, the thought came to me not too long ago that I think I may have an insight into this that I'm going to leave with you today for what it's worth. And it all dates back to 1965. Our understanding of the universe changed dramatically in 1965 when two physicists at the Bell Laboratory in Crawford Hill, New Jersey, Arno Penzias and Robert Woodrow Wilson, were working there at the Bell Labs in New Jersey. And these two individuals were working on an antenna that we were using to communicate with the Echo communication satellites back in the early to mid-60s. And that was the antenna they were working on. And in order to perfect it, they were needing to isolate all extraneous noise, including infrared radiation, which is emitted by anything that has a temperature. And so they tried to get this thing down as close as they could to absolute zero. And when they did that, wherever they pointed the telescope in the heavens, they kept getting this residual temperature that they couldn't account for of 3 or 4 degrees Kelvin above where they should be. What is this residual temperature? And everywhere they pointed it, they encountered it. And then eventually they came to the conclusion, the serendipitous conclusion, which had never even had entered their mind as part of this experiment, as part of their work, that what they had stumbled on was nothing less than the sounds of the universe in the state of being created. The residual radiation, noise from the creation of the cosmos. The cosmic background radiation is what it's called. You want to listen to it? This is 50 octaves below middle C, and I've recalibrated this so the human ear can hear it. What are we listening to? Romans 8:22. We know that the whole creation, wherever they pointed their telescope, has been groaning as in the pains of childbirth. You just heard it. Unknown before 1965. right up to the present time, not just 50 AD when Paul wrote those words, but to the present time of today. And so from an astronomer's perspective, how appropriate and how fitting that this very passage of Scripture, the whole creation has been groaning as in the pains of childbirth. We can detect noises now from all over the universe that are nothing less than the pangs of childbirth of the universe at the time of creation. That's been an astronomer's insight into Romans 8:22. I'll take any questions if you have some.
My question was, are any other nations beside ours interested in near-Earth objects? And if so, are they working with us or independently of us to either warn the planet of this or try to take measures to prevent these objects from hitting?
No, I would say the worldwide response has been almost non-existent. Our response hasn't been that great. But I would say that the vast majority of this research is being done at American facilities. Although it's a worldwide problem, obviously.
I'm curious when you say...
It's just like military spending. We have relieved Western European nations of the need to have military budget because of our canopy of protection. And so you look at France, you look at Germany, you look at some of these countries, they have a tiny fraction of their GNP devoted to defense compared to ours. We have become the policemen of the world. And that has relieved them of tremendous financial burdens that allows them to spend that surplus on various social network programs.
I'm curious when you say an object, say, the size of a house, if that were on trajectory to strike us, because I know that I think that some are, the size of a house in relative, you know, compared to the Earth, how much of that would burn off in entering our ozone? I mean, how much of that would be left when it came through?
Now, some would burn off. I don't know the exact ratio, and it depends on a number of things, including the angle, of the incident angle when it comes in. Is it a direct hit? Is it a glancing blow, in which case it could just skip off the atmosphere? It depends on a number of factors. But certainly at the right angle, an Earth size, a house size asteroid, there would be some remnant of it that would survive the cataclysmic entry into our atmosphere. You're going 70 miles a second, and you know you hit an atmosphere, and there's that friction. Just you know, put your hand out the window, going 70 miles an hour, and now increase that 1,000-fold, and there's tremendous heat and friction that results from that disintegrates smaller objects. We're struck by probably 8 billion objects a day, and the vast majority of them burn up in the upper atmosphere. In fact, those of you that have dark-colored cars, and you ever notice this? You spend all Saturday washing it, and you leave it outside in the driveway, and you come out on Sunday morning, and it's covered with dust. You know, where is this coming from? Do you know that most of that is micrometeorite dust? It is the remnants of billions of meteors and asteroids that have struck the atmosphere, disintegrated into dust, and are just that dust wafts down. It takes days and weeks for that to happen. But that's what's covering your car. That is, don't wash that off. That is your connection with the cosmos. Feel that car. Go to the Walmart parking lot. Go buy a dark car that looks like it's just been washed. Just put your hand across it and look at it. The owner says, hey, what are you doing in my car? I say, I'm just picking up micrometeorite dust. Any other questions? Gary.
Siberia.
Yeah, the Tunguska, probably a comet impact in Siberia. The Russians never let any Western scientist in to examine it until much more recent years. But that apparently is what happened. A Tunguska-sized impactor, NASA estimates, is about a once-in-a-century object. I had some slides here I didn't go over, including, in fact, I may go back and show this one slide. We passed this over pretty quickly, the Torino scale. This is the Torino scale, where NASA has tried to quantify the risk of to Earth of an impact event. And it starts with green. This is a normal, or no hazards, the white, zero at the top. And each level down, from down toward 10, the risk to Earth and to civilization becomes greater and greater and greater. The highest event so far has been a 4, and that was Apophis. That has now been, I think, downsized to maybe a 2. But as Arnold Toynbee, the great historian, once said, civilization exists at the pleasure of geology. I think that's a very secular view. Just in my fifth grade Sunday school class today, our lesson is the Book of Proverbs. It's kind of a challenge covering the Book of Proverbs in one day. But we did our best. I'll probably make it a 4-Sunday event. But we're going over Proverbs that mean a lot to me. And one we talked about today, I said, hey, I'm going to use this in Dr. Nunnally's class today, is for the faithful not to be distressed when disaster strikes. And what a great consolation of Scripture for us. We can look at these objects and look at the risk scale, and it doesn't have to concern us as Christians. Because, as I've often said, it doesn't matter when we die or how we die. All that matters is, are we ready to die? And to give things a long-term perspective, which I try to do, somebody cuts you off when you're driving rather than scream at that. I mean, how am I going to view this a year from now or 10 years from now? Not even going to remember it. Try to look at things in your daily life from a long-term perspective. And even from a million-year perspective is good as well. Who's going to care a million years from now how we died or how old we were? All that matters is, did Jesus Christ abide in us and us in him? Yeah. What's the difference between a comet and an asteroid? An asteroid is a rock. A comet is often referred to as a dirty snowball. It consists of ice, dust, and rock. As a result, when a comet, they all have orbits around the Earth, highly elliptical orbits. And when a comet passes by, we don't see a trail. All you see is, like here, a pinpoint. Now, if I was taking 1-second images, it would be indistinguishable from a star. Anything, if you take a long enough image, it's going to turn into star trails. But the thing about a comet is when it gets close to perihelion, closest point to the sun, the solar radiation begins to strip off some of the ice and some of the dust and rock and form a gaseous tail and a material tail. Comets usually have 2 tails, which doesn't happen with an asteroid due to the composition. The asteroid is solid rock and minerals. The comet has that plus ice and dust embedded in it.
A week ago yesterday, we were privileged to be at the NASA Space Center, Kennedy Space Station, and we watched almost an hour IMAX film on the Hubble telescope, and it was just amazing what they're seeing, and they talked about the nursery of where more stars are being built and this kind of thing. And I guess I walked out of there feeling like Dr. Bradford said he would do in some of his science classes, feeling like I had been in a worship service, to think how vast outer space is and what all is happening there all the time.
Yeah, I feel the exact same way. That's the power and the passion of astronomy. Out of my driveway at 2 o'clock in the morning when I'm taking pictures of a galaxy 100 million light years away, and I'm taking 5-minute subframes for a total of maybe a 3-hour image, and then I stack those frames so that if a plane goes overhead, I don't ruin a 3-hour picture. That's what most astronomers do. But when it downloads onto the screen in front of me as I'm sitting there in the cold and dark, and I see that next image just pop up on the screen and hear the spiral arms of this galaxy and countless galaxies in the background. Who knows how far away those things are? What vistas are there in that one galaxy that we'll never see? What Grand Canyons? What geographical, topographical figures? Is there life out there? I mean, there are just so many questions. But the overriding sensation to me is Psalms 19:1. The heavens declare the glory of God. When you begin to have a dim comprehension of the sizes, the size of things, the distance of things, it just is absolutely overwhelming, like nothing else that I've ever encountered in life, except my wife, perhaps. But it's it's just absolutely, it's so faith-inspiring to be out there at 2 o'clock in the morning. It's quiet. It's serene. It's peaceful. And you look up at the vastness of the heavens, and it's a time that you feel such a closeness to God, to the Creator. And it's a time of prayer for me. And really, I have often referred to astronomy as a form of worship. It puts you in direct contact with the Creator in a way that looking at a tree doesn't, in my opinion. Have we exhausted the questions? Thank you for the privilege of speaking today.